This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Today, Seattle is one step closer to replacing the aging Alaskan Way Viaduct and moving a two-mile section of Highway 99 underground. After nearly 4 years, the tunneling machine known as Bertha finished its dig underneath the city. KUOW's Kate Walters was there when Bertha finally broke through.
That is the sound of one of the biggest tunnel boring machines on Earth finally crossing the finish line. The huge round cut ahead looks like something out of a space movie as it grinds through the final barrier to daylight. After a nearly 2 mile dig under Seattle and more than 2 years of delays, Bertha is finally done. Washington Governor Jay Inslee says this is a momentous occasion and, despite the road bumps, he has no regrets.
When there were problems on this job, we were insistent that the contractor finish this job and fulfill its obligation to the people of the state of Washington. And today, when you see this tunnel boring, the only thing stronger I think I've seen is King Kong, and now we got ourselves a tunnel. So I'm glad we kept going.
The tunneling project has been a mammoth undertaking, and officials say its completion marks a key milestone in the effort to provide fast and reliable trips along State Route 99, for cars and for freight. They say the route supports the movement of more than $30 billion in cargo each year. King County Executive Dow Constantine says the completion of Bertha's dig is a defining moment for the region, on par with the founding of the University of Washington and the building of the Space Needle.
Those were moments that helped define what this region is and what we will become. And just as we completed this remarkable work of engineering today, we are going to continue to build because entropy is not a friend.
Bertha's job may be done, but it wasn't all smooth sailing. The tunneling machine overheated in late 2013, causing massive delays. The tunneling project could also come in as much as $149 million over budget. There's an ongoing court battle over who will pay for the cost overruns, but Seattle Mayor Ed Murray says it won't be the city.
We don't ask any city or county in this state to pay for a state project. If we begin asking one city to pay for it, all cities will pay for it. I don't think the legislature wants to go there.
As well as cost overruns, critics have questioned the decision to sink millions into a new highway in an era where climate change is such a big issue. But to tunnel contractor Chris Dixon, this milestone is historic and has implications beyond Seattle. He says the fact that one of the biggest machines in the world could cut through tough soil conditions under a major city opens the door for other projects like this.
I think with what we've proven here, it's going to create opportunities going forward for other large diameter tunnel projects that were never attempted in the past until we attempted it on this project.
Just a few blocks away from Bertha's final resting place, Wendell Wilson isn't thinking about more projects. He's surprised this one was finished at all.
No, I thought it was going to be at least another, one more breakdown in another year is what I was thinking.
Wilson drives State Route 99 every now and then, and even though he wasn't expecting it, he's glad Bertha's done and the new route is moving forward. Still, it'll be a while before Wilson or anyone else gets to drive through the new tunnel. Crews still have to complete the double-decker highway within and install electric, plumbing and safety systems. The old viaduct also has to be demolished and a toll rate still needs to be set. That's right, there will be tolls. All in all, the state estimates the tunnel will open to traffic in 2019. As for Bertha, the machine will be disassembled over the next 4 to 5 months. Its job is finally done. I'm Kate Walters, KUOW News.
And you just heard Washington State's Governor Jay Inslee there comparing the Bertha machine to King Kong. Well, you know, Kong never did pay for the expensive destruction he wreaked in Manhattan, not financially anyway. In about half an hour, I will ask Governor Inslee who's going to pay for that costly tunnel delay, among other issues we have to discuss with the governor about a half an hour from now. Stay tuned to KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. The time is 12:10. $175 for a steak dinner? The Japanese beef known as Kobe is hard to get in the United States, and it's pricey when it is available. But it's getting easier to find more affordable beef labeled American-style Kobe beef or so-called American Wagyu beef. You can bet the Japanese Trade Association for Kobe beef is not amused by that labeling. Our coverage begins now with correspondent Tom Bonsi at a steakhouse in Seattle's sister city, Kobe, Japan.
After much anticipation, the servers brought us a little tray of raw Kobe beef. This is supposedly the finest steak in the world, and you can see the marbling on the short ribs is really quite extraordinary. I put a little bit of it on the grill. And this being Japan, I'm going to eat my steak with chopsticks. Mmm. And that really is quite extraordinary. Super tender. Melts in your mouth. Traditional beef flavor. Now, boss, if you would give me a much, much bigger expense account and a travel budget, I could actually verify if this is the world's best beef. But in the meantime, we'll ask people who know a little bit more and eat more steak than I do.
Kobe beef is Japanese best standard, difficult standard beef.
Yasuo Sakani is the head waiter at a high-end teppanyaki restaurant in Kobe's Hotel Okura. A multi-course menu featuring Kobe beef here can easily reach $200 per person. This prized meat is cloaked in legend.
They get fed beer. Have you heard that? Or they play Mozart to the cows in the stable. They massage the beef. How much of this is true?
A little bit.
True.
Yes. Yes.
Sakani says he's heard classical music played and knows the pampered cattle sometimes get massages.
No stress, soft meat, beef. That's true. Relaxing cow.
On the other hand, beer swilling cows, not true. That urban legend might stem from a practice of some ranchers adding brewer's yeast to their cattle feed to impart a sweeter flavor to the fat. Japan enforces strict rules on what qualifies as genuine Kobe beef. The rules cover geography, bloodlines, lifespan, and grading of the meat. There's an industry association to promote and defend the brand. That association has long been unhappy about overseas ranchers and restaurants who label with terms such as Kobe style or American Kobe. Head waiter Sakani says he can't believe you can recreate Kobe beef overseas. The marketing manager for the largest American producer of Japanese-style beef replies from Boise that imitation is not his company's goal.
We are not aiming to reach the levels of marbling that they have in Kobe beef. It's something that there's a small market for in the United States, but the space that we're trying to occupy is between prime and Japanese Wagyu.
Seth Mortensen works for Agribeef, producer of the Snake River Farms brand of premium beef. He says Agribeef owns a herd of full-blood Japanese Wagyu cattle. It crossbreeds those animals with domestic U.S. beef cattle to produce a blended meat profile.
So the reason that we're doing that is Kobe beef is meant to be eaten, you know, thin sliced, very small portions. In the United States, when we think of eating beef, we think of eating a steak.
Mortensen says Snake River Farms formerly used the term American-style Kobe beef to introduce its product, but it now labels its packaging as American Wagyu. Literally translated, Wagyu means Japanese cow. Mortensen says Wagyu is becoming better known in the U.S., and using that term reduces confusion about origins. One way you'll know the tender beef caught on is if somebody's parents names them Wagyu. Because, true fact, basketball superstar Kobe Bryant is named after a memorable Kobe steak. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. I'm going to share with you now an email that I got from a KUOW listener. I've gotten several notes like this in the last few years. He opens with how much he appreciates KUOW. However, quote, "I'm concerned about the increasing number of stories that use white privilege with the implication that being white unlocks every door and makes every dream come true." Now, this listener's reacting to something that I'm sure you've seen as well, especially online, right? You'll see people calling each other out for having privilege. They might say, "Check your privilege," or YPIS, which stands for "Your privilege is showing." Okay, so that same listener goes on to say, "I got into a discussion on Facebook about this and was basically told I just didn't get it when I tried to say that I've never enjoyed those benefits and have had to work hard for everything I've got. Stories that make people feel bad about themselves, regardless of the intent, are not successful stories, especially when they reference an entire racial group." I appreciate that listener writing in and expressing those thoughts, and we're taking your calls as well right now at 206-543-5869. My next guest argues that calling people out on their privilege is a kind of shaming, and it's gone too far. Her new book is called The Perils of Privilege: Why Injustice Can't Be Solved by Accusing Others of Advantage. Again, join us now. Call in and share your experience. When have you called someone else out on their privilege? How did it feel? How did it go? If you've been called out for your privilege, what was that like? Our phone number is 206-543-5869. 543-5869. The author of The Perils of Privilege is Phoebe Maltz-Bovey. Thank you for coming, Phoebe.
Thanks so much for having me.
I appreciate that you opened your book with a laugh. You quote the Monty Python sketch where four Yorkshiremen are bragging about their difficult childhoods. You were lucky to have a house. We lived 26 to a room. Well, we lived in a hole in the ground.
Oh, well, we were evicted from our hole in the ground. We had to go and live in the lake.
Hey, you were lucky to have a lake. There are over 150 of us living in a small shoebox in the middle of the road.
Cardboard box?
Right.
Oh, you were lucky.
And Phoebe, you see a problem with accusing each other of being lucky and privileged. What's the problem?
Well, so I think that I want to be very clear on what the problem is not, which is sort of helpful, I think, to explain what the problem is. So the letter you mentioned receiving from somebody who didn't enjoy being accused of white privilege, I think it's true that society is racist and that white people, on average, do have things easier. I think the problem with using the term privilege for a case like this is it already has a meaning. It already means wealthy, luxurious, all of this. So if you tell somebody who's white but doesn't in general have it easy that they're privileged, they may reject this even if they wouldn't reject the notion that society is racist. So I think if you want to convince people, especially white people, to try to fight against racism, overshooting the mark in a way rhetorically can be a problem. But I think the overall assessment that it's easier, all things equal, if you're white is absolutely true.
Well, I thought that getting the attention of poor white people, for example, is part of the truth here, is that you can be, yeah, you can be poor and advantaged. Isn't that interesting? And here's how. I thought that was the idea.
I think that that is the idea, and I think that that is a point that needs to get across. I think the problem is the word privilege has this existing meaning. It doesn't mean just advantage. It means sort of just a generally luxurious, easy breezy existence. And that's just not going to be, I mean, for it's, so my book isn't just about the question of white privilege,
right,
or even particularly about that. It's about all different uses of privilege. So if you take something like male privilege, do men on average have it easier? Yes. Does every man have an easy breezy life? No.
What's a better word than privilege?
I would say just unearned advantage is good if you're trying to talk about the advantage itself. But if you're trying to talk about a specific instance, I think it's better to talk about sexism, racism, things like this, which better get at what's going on. Because I think what happens when you tell somebody, check your privilege or your privilege is showing or something like this, what you end up doing is you switch the conversation to one about this person's inner life that's sort of just goes off on its own tangent and really doesn't have anything to do with whatever you were ostensibly talking about.
Well, you could argue that the term privilege and white privilege, and yes, there are many kinds of privilege, as you write about, that's worked as a label because we're still talking about it and you're writing a book about it. So the idea of privilege seems to have broken through. I can say personally that I've learned a lot in recent years about the complexity and the cumulative effects of different kinds of privilege.
Well, so I think in terms of what's succeeded or not, so that's really what I get to at the end of my book is I look at, has this word, has this concept of privilege actually improved matters?
Mm-hmm.
An obvious thing that's happened actually since the book came out is that Donald Trump was elected president. So it doesn't strike me that deeper privilege awareness among, especially among liberals, has necessarily led to a society where things are more fair. It seems like there's just this kind of ritual of awareness that people on the left will frequently sort of engage in that doesn't necessarily translate to convincing anybody, or for that matter, I think what ends up happening is people who all fundamentally agree with one another on the left wind up calling out one another rather than really addressing the other side.
We're talking with Phoebe Maltz-Bovey, author of The Perils of Privilege, and we're taking your phone call. What happens when you call out someone as privileged? When has that gone well? When has it gone badly, and why? 206-543-5869, 543-5869. Was the Donald Trump election, was that the tipping point for you? Or was it something else that happened to cause you to identify the privilege call-out as a problem?
Okay, so it definitely wasn't the election, because I finished writing it just about when Trump was nominated. This was really a phenomenon I had noticed online, really more like around 2009, 2010, where people would call one another out, especially in like blog comment threads. So sort of a precursor to Twitter pylons and such. And it was people who, by all accounts, had about the same amount of privilege would just use "you're privileged, you don't get it" to sort of win arguments, even when there was no reason to think one had different experiences than another. So it wasn't, what I first noticed wasn't specifically in discussions of white privilege. It was more just discussions of sort of an unspecified privilege, like sort of socioeconomic, but not even made that clear.
Let's take a call. We're talking to Angel in Madison Park, Seattle now. Angel, what's your comment or question?
My comment is that I've called out people on this. I think there's white privilege. There's also American privilege. And sometimes as Americans, we make judgments. White Americans sometimes make judgments without contextualizing the fact that they have this privilege.
And how do you call people out about that, and how does that go? How does it go, well or badly, Angel?
Well, the first time I think I really, really was probably a little aggressive about it. This is back in 1988. I was an investment advisor at a brokerage firm. 97 brokers, 94 white males. And for whatever reason, they couldn't see the advantages they had.
And how did it go when you called them out?
In that position.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say for a while there, it was, you know, they would disagree with me, and then one day I was all of a sudden the top broker in the office, and I had the corner office, and said, "See, you know, you don't have to be white, you know," and that led me to doing a lot more research, and I've actually bought a pile of these books called The Color of Wealth. I think it was published in 2008, for the name of the author, and I hand them out.
Okay.
And I just say, look, I can sit and argue with you all day long, but first you need to get a little context.
Educate yourself. The author of The Perils of Privilege, Phoebe Maltz-Bovey, is with us. Phoebe, do you have any reaction to that attempt?
Yes. Yeah, so I think that making people aware of their privilege, it can have value, but only if people will then, who once made aware, try to get rid of that privilege, try to make society more fair, more just, so that they're no longer benefiting from whichever unearned form of advantage. I think the problem with the privilege call out, just sort of fundamentally, is that what happens if you tell white men that they, you know, look how, like, please acknowledge your privilege, and they say, yep, I'm privileged. And then you have these all white male, photo ops with Trump in the White House. You know, I think it doesn't, the fact that privilege is acknowledged doesn't necessarily, unfortunately, mean that anybody's going to personally try to get rid of theirs or to try to change society to make it less unfair.
But then couldn't you say that calling out someone on privilege is necessary, just not sufficient?
I think that calling out someone on racism or sexism. And I don't mean necessarily saying you are a, in that sort of framework. I mean, just saying what you just said was sexist, what you just said was racist, you know, not you, you know what I mean, in yeah. these, in a conversation, is definitely, whether it's productive or not, it can be satisfying. You know, there are a lot of important reasons to do that. I think the problem with calling somebody out on privilege is it's just not necessarily clear what you're supposed to do with that assertion. So if you tell somebody who's rich, gee, aren't you privileged? They will know this. What next? All the best that you can kind of get is they're going to say, well, you know, now that, yep, that's true, let me acknowledge this and go on being rich and go on benefiting from things I didn't necessarily earn.
Well, I think that's why the society has moved from just saying, well, it must be great to be rich, it's so easy, and moved to a more umbrella term like privilege. And as I was saying, the point being, yeah, you don't have to be rich to be privileged. You prefer the term unearned advantage. I want to ask whether, are we talking, Phoebe, really about defensiveness? Because I've learned a lot in recent years about the cumulative effect of, I knew wealth was stolen from slaves and indigenous people and trickled down to many white people, including me. But I've been educated over my life about the cumulative effect of trusting the police to protect me and having my teachers and my role models look like me and looking and acting acceptable to the majority, on and on and on. But I've never felt guilty about it. So I'm wondering, if privileged people feel defensive, shouldn't we focus on our defensiveness instead of the accusing? Well,
so what I think is important, I think it's important to teach and learn about systemic racism, mm-hmm. which is what you're talking about. And I really do think that's important. And the point of my book is certainly not to dismiss that. Now, I do have questions about whether I think society on the whole has moved in the direction that you describe going in yourself. I don't think, unfortunately, that that's the case, you know, witness Trump's success. I think the question is really more whether it helps on an individual-to-individual basis. So there's sort of two questions. One is whether it helps on an individual-to-individual basis to speak of privilege when the fact that all things equal, a white person has it easier, doesn't necessarily tell you anything about specific people. But also the question is whether it makes sense to talk about privilege when what you're really talking about is injustice and the fact that life isn't fair enough for many people, rather than trying to tell people who have just sort of okay that they have too much, when what you really want to do is make sure that people who don't have enough have opportunities and all of this.
Right. That's interesting. Some people would say that stuff's not privilege. That's how it ought to be for everybody. That should be
exactly.
A right.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Okay.
Absolutely.
I do want to get to some solutions from you, from your point of view, Phoebe Maltz-Bovey, what we can do better. I want to take a phone call from Louis in Rainier Beach, because Louis, you had a successful attempt at pointing out someone's privilege. What happened?
Hi. How's it going? Yeah. So a while back, we were just driving along with my older brother, and you know, we saw a Black Lives Matter sign, and you know, he kind of made just an ignorant, off the cuff kind of comment, like, "Oh, stupid black people," and you know, "All lives matter" kind of deal, and you know, he doesn't live here, obviously, and so you know, I kind of just kept quiet a little bit and just kind of processed my thoughts, and you know, inside my heart was beating a little bit, kind of nervous, and you know, it's my brother. He's never not going to be my brother. I love him, but you know, I wanted to challenge that ignorance and notion that, you know, like, why does he think that and where that comment came from, and kind of unpack it with him. So I started just kind of asking questions. So do you understand the history behind that terminology? Do you understand, like, why communities of color feel that way and why people feel that way too? And so he's like, no, not really. And so we kind of went into a little bit of how, you know, of course, it's kind of like, duh, all lives matter. Everybody knows that all lives matter, but the actions of history, you know, in American culture and police brutality, it says otherwise. And so we kind of had to highlight that for him a little bit. And then he started kind of really just kind of go backwards on kind of the passion behind what he was saying. And you know, he actually didn't even know that I felt that way too until that moment happened. And so, and then later on that night, you know, we just had dinner and it was normal in a sense. But that was a moment that definitely... I feel like it was a good outcome of kind of challenging somebody on ignorance on that level.
Well, Well, thanks a lot, Louis. In Rainier Beach, there's an example of something you can do that thoughtful questions in a conversation can be more effective than a four-letter acronym for your privileges showing. What about that? Finally, yeah, Phoebe Maltz-Bovey, your final thoughts?
Yeah, so I think that that's a great example of how a conversation can go. And I think whether you use the word privilege or not, I think what happens is if you're talking to somebody one-on-one and you care about each other and this isn't just some stranger on the internet, you should absolutely educate the people in your life. And I think that's when these discussions tend to go the best, is when specifics are used. And that what's so interesting about that conversation was it wasn't one brother telling another your privilege is showing. It was an explanation of how society works and what's unfair. And I think that that's exactly the conversation people should be having.
You know, social media doesn't work like that, right?
I do know that, yes.
Yes, I know. What I'm taking away is that discussion of privilege, and as we've said, there are many kinds, has shrunk to a gotcha. And it sounds like overly personalized. Mm-hmm. It becomes personalized instead of about systems that we all actually care about.
Exactly. Because I think the goal shouldn't be, in this case, convincing one's sibling that they, you know, haven't deeply examined their own psyche. The point is to explain about how society is unfair. And that's why I think an expression like Black Lives Matter is actually very clear. It means that Black Lives Matter. And it doesn't require the same sort of unpacking as your privilege is showing, because what does your privilege is showing exactly mean? What is it even saying? You know, so I think that just clarity is always good, and also trying to keep the discussion either about a specific thing you want to call somebody out on having said or done, or if you're just trying to educate somebody, speaking of systems and not trying to force that sort of privilege epiphany in another person.
That's really helpful. I can relate to that. We have these conversations a lot, so thanks for making them a little better. Phoebe Maltz-Bovey, author of The Perils of Privilege, Why Injustice Can't Be Solved by Accusing Others of Advantage. Phoebe, thanks for being on KUOW.
Thanks so much.
More of KUOW's The Record just ahead, with Canadians being turned away at the border and a conversation with your Governor Jay Inslee. Stay tuned. It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. A big, beautiful wall along the border of the U.S. and Canada is not in the works. That's a southern thing. But U.S. border agents are reportedly turning away some Canadians at border checkpoints. U.S. Customs and Border Protection has declined to comment on individual cases. They did tell NPR that officers have broad discretion in deciding who gets to cross the border. Here to tell you what's going on, Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hiya, Vaughn.
Hi, Bill.
Who's getting stopped at the border and why?
Well, we're starting to hear a lot of anecdotal evidence. I mean, I don't think it's been too soon to say there's statistics for this year, but I'll give you one. I had dinner on Friday with a good friend of mine who lives in Victoria, here in the capital of BC, but he's an American citizen and he works in the United States, so he commutes back and forth quite a bit on the flight from Victoria to California. He said that in years of doing this, he's only ever been stopped twice, and both times it was this year. And both times just challenged him on his paperwork, security check. He got in, but he said his impression is the checks are getting a lot tougher. And I know that NPR did that story that you just referenced, Bill, about stories right across Canada. You're hearing from Canadians, you're hearing from being asked for visas, security checks, do you have a criminal record? And in the case of the friend I just told you about, you've got somebody who's actually an American citizen but lives in Canada, and even he is being challenged at the border.
Yes, I understand that some people are saying yes to the question, do you have a criminal record, because it was a pot offense 30 years ago or what have you, and not being able to come into this country because of it.
Yeah, that's right. And we've heard these stories over the years, and that's where I say it may just be anecdotal.
Right.
People may be paying more attention, Bill, because of the Trump thing and the immigration issues between Canada and the United States. The other thing is travel by Canadians to the United States is down for the reason it's often down in the past, which is that the Canadian dollar is down, the American dollar is high, so fewer Canadians are going to the United States than have in the past. But, you know, we'll know more statistically, I think, more toward the end of the year. Every year, several thousand people are denied entry coming into the United States from Canada. Whether the number is up or whether the border people are just paying more attention and checking more often, we don't know that yet.
Yes, good point. I'm glad you're pointing out that this is neither a trend nor a necessarily meaningful trend yet. We will watch it. Also, Vaughn,
people are sensitive, though. I think that's the point.
Yes.
Right? And people are paying more attention to a lot of things with the new president.
Yeah, exactly right. And our common border, Vaughn, is also in the news because our federal government is contemplating a border adjustment tax. Will you remind us basically how that would work?
Essentially, goods imported to the United States from Canada would be subject to a tax, and it's a kind of a complicated thing because it includes value-added issues. There would be an issue over whether or not it was an American company exporting jobs to Canada to make goods and then bringing them back to the United States. The Canadian government's pretty concerned about this because the two economies are so integrated and have been for years, that because we haven't seen the actual wording of the legislation, we don't know for sure, but our concern is it could have a lot of unintended consequences. Like the most obvious example that's often mentioned is the automobile manufacturing thing. So you have automobile parts that are manufactured in Canada, shipped to the United States, assembled sometimes only partially into vehicles in the United States, and then the vehicles are sent back to Canada to be finished, and vice versa. This has been going on since the 1960s under a Canada-U.S. agreement, the Auto Pact, which predates NAFTA by 30 years. So Canadian government saying, look, our read of this is that this could hurt the United States as much as Canada because this trade back and forth in goods and final assembly employs people in the United States as well as in Canada, and if you start to untangle it with a tax, you could have unintended consequences on both sides of the border.
And finally, Vaughn, is that argument that this is going to hurt you more than it's going to hurt us, is there any evidence that that's resonating either among the American public or President Trump or both?
Well, I mean, from what I've seen coverage in the United States, there are a number of members of Congress who've already raised this issue, particularly in border states. This affects the states right across the United States border with Canada. It affects the Rust Belt states because, of course, the automobile industry is still based in. I mean, if you look at the states that switched from Democrat to Republican and put Trump over the top, a lot of them are very dependent on the automobile trade and some of this other manufacturing stuff. So, no, I think the Canadian government feels it's connected. We're still warning. Our finance minister was in New York just these past few days delivering a speech warning an American audience that, look, it could hurt your economy as much as it hurts ours, so be very careful how you proceed with this.
That's Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer filling you in on border issues, and they seem to be mounting. Vaughn, good to speak with you again.
Talk to you soon, Bill.
Good.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon. KUOW Seattle with Governor Jay Inslee in a moment. Stick around. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us today. Bertha is resting comfortably today. After 4 years underground drilling Seattle's waterfront tunnel, she is feeling rain again and getting caught up on everything she missed. She's finding out that Donald Trump is president. She has been shown the new Pepsi ad with Kendall Jenner. Even Bertha thinks that ad is stupid, and she's an inanimate object. And most of all, Bertha is getting wind of all the controversy she caused. Not only is she 2 years late, she's, $100 million or so over budget, and someone's going to pay those costs, but who? That is just one of the questions I have for Washington's Governor Jay Inslee. Welcome, Governor.
You bet. Thank you.
We'll talk more about President Trump in a moment. But in 2015, after Bertha got stuck, you pointed at the contractor, Seattle Tunnel Partners.
We should not let this contractor off the hook. They owe us a tunnel or they owe us a heck of a lot of money, one of the two.
They only owe us one of the two, Governor? It sounds like now that we have a tunnel, are they off the hook?
No, I think it's both, actually, because we do have outstanding litigation to protect the citizens of Washington. And I do believe there's a lot of reasons for confidence that the citizens will be protected for a couple reasons. We know the two big reasons for this delay. One was that the contractor had a lack of quality control. And as you recall, when the sinkhole opened up, our Department of Transportation was forced to halt the project until the contractor really adopted a new management quality control system. And they did do that. And as a result, they finished the last several thousand feet in short order once they actually had their act together. The second thing is, and this might involve a little discussion, this really was not Bertha that finished this tunnel. It was Bertha 2. This is essentially a brand new, a redesigned machine.
Like a whole different product.
Yeah, it's a whole different product. Because what happened was when the machine was found to be incapable of actually tunneling, they went in and removed it in a Herculean feat. They put in 86 tons of new steel to stiffen it so essentially it wouldn't wobble. They redesigned the entire seals to protect the bearings. They came up with a new electronic system.
Why is all that significant, Governor? That fact it's so revamped.
It's significant to show who is responsible for the delay. It is the state's position, and I think will be proved at trial, that the delay was caused because the machine just would not tunnel. They essentially started, forgive the metaphor, with sort of a four-cylinder Datsun. It didn't cut the mustard. It could not tunnel. It kept overheating because of multiple problems with the machine. They then went in and took it apart, rebuilt in fundamental ways the machine, then finished it with sort of a F-150, you know, eight-cylinder Ford. This is a new machine that they redesigned.
Okay. And
the first one didn't work.
If the state were to lose in court, if the court said it's not the contractor's fault, there was a pipe in the ground that Bertha hit, or whatever, would the state try to make Seattle taxpayers pay?
Well, the attorney generals have been pretty clear that that the provision in the original language is not binding, so I don't think that the language that would purport to put responsibility in Seattle is going to be found to be binding. So I don't believe that that's the direction. But I'll tell you why I'm confident about this. You know, yesterday when we saw it break through the wall, if you go back and look at the tape, it's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. It shows this thing playing with rebar like it's silly putty. You know, these inch-thick pieces of steel that were just snapping back and forth. This 8-inch pipe argument, it just isn't going to cut it. This thing would go through an 8-inch pipe like cheese.
Okay.
The fact of the matter is they didn't have a machine at work. Now, to their credit, it was pretty amazing that they were able to redesign it and fix it. You know, you got to give hats off to them for that.
Finally, on this topic, the Alaskan Way Viaduct could collapse in the next big earthquake. When are we taking that down?
Well, I have made sure that the next big earthquake will be after my administration.
Good.
So we've got that particular problem resolved.
We're all happy to hear that.
We don't have a date for that. There is no showstoppers on the horizon now that we've got the tunnel dug.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's reason to believe that there'll be any huge reason why that cannot be done in good order. And I hope that it is done before the next earthquake. It is a vulnerable structure.
Okay. Again, that tunnel, Bertha has broken through. The tunnel was supposed to open to traffic 2 years ago. The latest estimate is early 2019. Now, moving on to President Trump. The president has proposed cutting $28 million from Puget Sound restoration, which means stormwater treatment, salmon recovery, cleanups, research. But before that Trump cut happened, you also proposed cutting about that much from the state's Puget Sound restoration budget. Why is that?
Well, we have the financing source for a lot of that is in our model toxics account, which is driven by the price of fuel, frankly. And that has gone down dramatically, so it has dried up the source of money that has gone in. So we've maintained, to the extent humanly possible, this investment. And I'm very hopeful that Senator Murray, Senator Cantwell, our congressional delegation, will stop this very wrong-headed approach by President Trump, who in so many different ways has disregarded the obligation of the federal government to help with our environment. And Puget Sound, he really is trying to give it a 1-2 punch because he's trying to got the funding for the system.
But why is that a federal?
Away,
You know, I understand Trump wants to cut money for medical research, which we do a lot in the Seattle area. And it's obvious, I think, how medical research done here helps the whole country. But why shouldn't our state pay for Puget Sound restoration or regional transit projects, et cetera?
Well, we do. We're making billion-dollar investments on these with our state dollars. But there is a federal component. The federal government has recognized a federal interest in protecting the jewels in our crown, the Chesapeake, other areas, this estuary. And it has been clearly shown that this is one of the most beautiful, productive estuaries in the nation. So there's no reason to gut that funding. But what I want to add is the other punch that he's thrown at Puget Sound is by essentially trying to eliminate our protection against climate change and carbon pollution. Carbon pollution is really jeopardizing Puget Sound because it is acidifying Puget Sound. Puget Sound is 30% more acidic than it was before we started burning coal and oil. And it is just really painful that we have a president who's so willfully ignorant about the science of climate change and ocean acidification that he would essentially try to eliminate all of our actions to deal with that. So I've made clear both to the federal government and to the world, I was actually spoke to the UN a couple weeks ago about this, wanted them to know that Washington's going to continue to move forward to protect Puget Sound from carbon pollution. I've imposed a carbon rule that will reduce carbon pollution. We have new research at the University of Washington in clean energy. We're electrifying our fleet. We've had the greenest transportation package in state history. So we're going to move forward to protect Puget Sound one way or another.
Governor, has President Trump, we're talking with Governor Jay Inslee, obviously, has President Trump ever threatened you, directly or indirectly threatened you for opposing him on climate change and immigration and health insurance reform? Have you ever heard that from the White House or from the president?
No, but it wouldn't matter because it's not me that's at interest here. It's the state of Washington.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah,
healthcare.
Do you think he's targeting states?
He has threatened Washington big time. Mm-hmm. No more so than other states. No, I mean there's nothing that, except perhaps in the sanctuary city. I think he singled out Seattle a bit in his discussions. I think he's done that. That's the one place where I think he's probably tried to have his pound of flesh. I do believe he will fail in that regard, however, though, because we are in our state and, to my knowledge, cities are complying with federal law. We are following the federal law. The fact of the matter is the president cannot force local police departments to act as mini ICE agents. It's actually unconstitutional and illegal. We've already seen a court decision from Oregon in that regard. So I think we're on good grounds. We're doing the right thing. We're protecting people's safety in their communities. We want officers to have the cooperation of witnesses. We want crime victims who are be willing to come forward. Domestic violence victims need to be able to willing to come forward and try to get them from being, beat up by their family members. And we've got to maintain the ability to talk to law enforcement about that. So I think he will lose on that, just like he's lost so far in health care, and I hope that will continue.
What about marijuana? Do you think the Justice Department's talk against state legal marijuana is just talk, or do you think they're going to follow through?
We know that the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, personally has been on kind of a vendetta against marijuana. But I'm hopeful that will not translate into a wholesale attack on the progress that's being made in multiple states. I think there's...
Well, the industry wants to know, what can we expect? What do you tell them?
I'd have to tell them, stay tuned. No one can make a prediction.
Okay.
This is an extremely unpredictable. So I can't give an assessment. I've asked for a meeting with the Attorney General. We have not had a response to our request in that regard. And frankly, what I would do is we would want to share with him what our experience has been in Washington, which has been quite a well-regulated market. We're improving the safety to consumers. We've got a vigorous, although it can be a more vigorous educational efforts for our children about marijuana. The revenue is coming in to support multiple services for Washingtonians. So it's been quite a positive effort so far, and he needs to know about that. So I hope there is a chance that we can talk to the administration at some point.
In any case, Trump is cutting federal money to states, as we've said, and given that our state is already under a court order to spend more on our schools, and we'll get to that, how will you deal with even less money coming in? What do you do about it?
Well, I got to tell you, I do not believe the president's tweets 4.5% of the time. I don't believe they translate into policy. They're eruptions of 5 o'clock in the morning of someone who doesn't demonstrate a lot of discipline. And many, if not most, of the things he said he's going to do, he's not going to be able to accomplish. He told us he was going to give us a great, you know, coverage for every American with great health insurance. Didn't happen. He said he was going to, you know, tear up NAFTA. Didn't happen. You could get rich betting against this president on things he says he's going to make happen that simply do not happen. So we have Congress, which can play a very important role on the appropriations process. We have an excellent delegation in the Senate. Patty Murray is in a very powerful position in the Senate. Maria Cantwell is obviously plays an important role. So I think much of the anxiety on the appropriation side will not come to pass. It does not mean that we should be quiescent or passive. We should be as vocal as possible. Being vocal has had an impact. Look, when people were vocal, we stopped dead in its tracks the Republican effort to take away Medicaid insurance from 600,000 people. And that happened because people spoke up in Washington. They couldn't go to town hall meetings because the Republicans won't hold them, but they got their message across.
People actually, Senators Murray speaking. And Cantwell aren't holding public town hall meetings either.
They don't need to. They got the people with them, and they know what the message is, which is protect our health care, fight climate change, and have a decent educational system. They know that, and they've got the people with them. That's a message that some of our Republican colleagues didn't want to hear.
Well, the red part of the state might disagree. This is Governor Jay Inslee. You and Democratic legislators want a state tax on capital gains, which is the money people make when they sell investments like a stocks or a house. You also proposed a carbon tax. Aren't those both, as they say, dead on arrival in the legislature?
No, I think there are a lot of ideas that have now been proposed. I wouldn't count any of them sort of dead on arrival at all, in part because this is a very steep hill to climb to come up with the billions of dollars necessary for schools. So there's going to have to be some new revenue sources. And I think it behooves all of us going into this negotiation, which is now actually going to start, to be open to all kinds of ideas. I will tell you, and by the way, you mentioned sale of houses. The proposal of capital gains does not apply to the sales of houses.
Oh, okay. Or retirement accounts, right?
Or retirement accounts of any of those proposals. It would affect less than 1% of Washingtonians, but still generate hundreds of millions of dollars for schools. But I do think that is a better proposal than what the Republicans have proposed. They have proposed raising the property tax by $5 billion. And would severely impact homeowners, particularly those on fixed income, veterans, senior citizens. They all get hit by this property tax increase. And they did not have a concomitant reduction of the local property tax. So it essentially about 40% of all the homeowners and businesses in the state of Washington would end up paying more property tax and yet not increase by any significant amount the dollars going to schools. And to me, it's just incredible that Republicans want to raise taxes $5 billion, not give a concomitant tax cut, and not actually put real money into schools. That's the number one job this year in the legislative session, is to put real money in schools. My budget, the House Democrats put about $6 billion into schools, better mentoring, more computers, better textbook, better support for NEED grant, early child education. The Republicans have shortchanged all of those things. At the same time, they propose gutting our mental health care system. So we have a lot of work to do.
As you know, Republicans say we are going to make cuts because we can't afford the spending we're doing, because, as you just said, we're billions behind on education, et cetera. And they say we don't have an income tax. It's been found unconstitutional. We are willing to raise the taxes we do have, and that if a capital gains tax or many of these other more progressive taxes, once they're under the tent, they just get ratcheted up. More and more people pay them. Isn't that kind of how taxes tend to work?
Well, let me make clear, the Republicans have proposed raising billions of dollars of taxes themselves this year. Okay, I want to make clear. Maybe this is sort of news, so it's hard for people to appreciate it. They have proposed over $5 billion increases in a state property tax.
Right.
38% of people would have a net increase in their property tax, regardless of their particular income. So it's not really so much a question of whether taxes are going to be raised, but by which one, and that's what the legislators are going to have to grapple with. Now, the alternative is to cut other state spending, but I got to just be honest with you, the Republican budget is sort of a ghost budget because they've penciled in cuts that they know are not going to happen. For instance, they've essentially zeroed out improvements at Western State Hospital. We've had to improve our treatment of our patients at Western State Hospital. They know they are not going to pass those ultimately. In fact, they're actually telling people, don't worry about it. This is just a bumper sticker. These cuts aren't actually going to happen. And they realize then there will have to be revenues that will have to be discussed of a little greater magnitude that they've proposed.
Okay, final question, Governor. We just have 1 minute left. Governor Inslee, today in the legislature, Republicans are trying to claw back money from Sound Transit because Sound Transit calculated drivers' car tab fees by essentially inflating the value of their used cars. Who's in the right here, and what are you doing about it?
Well, what I want to see happen is that the voters' intent is followed, and the intent of the voters were to build a light rail system from Everett to Tacoma. We do want to make sure we can get that done. But I also believe that there's been real sticker shock to a lot of people, and the method for valuing cars that were used in the initiative, is skewed and kind of hard to understand and accept. So there is discussion about some modifications to this that would reduce some of the sticker shock, have a system that might be more tenable with real life, but make sure we finish this job because voters want to make sure this project gets built. There's discussion ongoing in both caucuses about that. We hope that happens.
Governor, that's our time. Thanks. We'll talk again.
Thanks for this. You bet.
Governor Jay Inslee, live on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Thanks for listening.